You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 9th of September 2016 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Coming up on today's programme...
The roofs leak. You walk around the place and there are buckets with a portcullis sign on it. You see rats in the place. You see the stonework crumbling. A whole range of things are going wrong and have been going wrong for a long time.
Britain's politicians have approved a £4 billion restoration of the Houses of Parliament. Is it costing too much? Also ahead, 30 people spent the night trapped in cable cars in the French Alps. We'll ask our editors about the strangest place they've spent the evening. And also ahead...
What does this mean for Britain's nightlife and for London's nightlife? Because we, sadly, we've got a 24-hour tube on Friday and Saturday nights in some parts of the city. We ain't got nowhere to go.
In the week that one of London's most celebrated clubs is forced to close, we discuss if our cities are doing enough to promote a vibrant nighttime economy. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So welcome, one and all, to Midori House. My guests today are all Monocle staff. I have Tom Edwards, our executive producer, Matt Alagaya, our business editor, Nolan Giles, our design editor, will be joining us a little bit later, but also... He's not in Istanbul. He's right here in the studio. Christopher Lord, our Istanbul bureau chief, is here with us too. So welcome to... Well, there's three of you in here at the moment. We'll welcome Nolan when he gets there. The UK's Houses of Parliament are getting a makeover, and it's not a cheap one. The Gothic Victorian buildings are in such a bad state that it's going to cost £4 billion to put them right. The award-winning political documentary maker Michael Cockerell spent a year making a series about Westminster, and here he is speaking to the Monocle Daily last night.
It's very bad. I mean, I spent last year making a series for the BBC called Inside the Commons, and I was shocked by some of the things I found. For instance, the roofs leak. You walk around the place and there are buckets with a portcullis sign on it. One MP told me that the urinal leaked onto his desk from the floor above. You see rats in the place. You see the stonework crumbling. A whole range of things are going wrong and have been going wrong for a long time. Even Big Ben itself is on a tilt, the Leaning Tower of Pisa it could become.
Wow. Big Ben on a tilt, could fall over. I think I've seen that film. Tom Edwards, I mean... I must say, the people of Britain are unlikely to be up in arms about the fact of piss falling on MPs, are they?
Well, this is the thing. I can't hear any details about the story without the sort of metaphorical resonance striking. I think there's a big problem here. We've got, a population that's slightly fallen out of love and out of trust with the political classes quite broadly, mm-hmm. and there's a general scepticism or cynicism about Westminster. And I think when the buildings are literally rotten and people feel the edifice metaphorically is rotten, it's a rather unfortunate time to say, by the way, we need £4 billion to sort of get everything shipshape. I'm a fairly traditional fellow, Steve. I'm no radical. But I do wonder whether it would send quite a positive message to raise this edifice, the rotten husk, and start again with something a bit more contemporary that's a bit more connected to people's lives. It would certainly be hugely better value for the taxpayer.
And you could even, perhaps, Matt Alagaya, use some of that £4 billion to rebuild people's houses, which might be suffering from similar problems.
Let's not go too fast.
And there is no taxpayer money coming to help them. Or am I just being slightly facetious about
this? You might be there. And also, I feel like Tom is being a little bit too radical there. Raising the whole thing to the ground is a nice idea. But I feel like it's actually a building that a lot of people love. and it brings a lot of people to the country. You know, a lot of tourists will go there specifically to see the building. What I do think, though, I mean, you mentioned, you know, it's a lot of money, but you can treat this as a bit of an opportunity. I mean, people are talking about having Parliament sit in Birmingham or another city now while they're doing the renovations. Obviously,
it'll come, I like.
It will come, yeah, Birmingham, all right. But, you know, it'll come back to London, obviously, at some point. But it would be nice if 8 to 10 years, Parliament sat outside London and outside the Westminster bubble. I mean, it would probably just become the Birmingham bubble, but at least it'd be a nice change.
We're okay with the Birmingham bubble.
Okay.
Yeah. Chris Lord, let's not get into Birmingham versus Manchester. Mm. We'd save that for another time. But is there also another side to this story, which is that it suggests that this is a building that hasn't been looked after for some time? It's, you don't get hit with a £4 billion rebuilding bill, as it were, if you've been patching up and making amendments here and there over time.
That's right. I mean, I think that's the story of quite a lot of our infrastructure here in the UK, you know, is that a lot of it has been taped over and not had that big refresh. I mean, that short clip that you played then just shows it's sort of an endemic problem there. It's sort of slowly, bits of it are sort of rotting away, really. I mean, I think it's, yeah, I think this sort of is a bit of a sign, really, and generally in the UK, and a lot of these sort of public buildings have just not kept pace with the country, really. A lot of them have just been taped over, little bits of restoration here and there, and not had those big projects that they should have had in the past, I would say.
Matt?
It's also one of those things where no politician is willing to be the person who says, this needs to be done now. It's kind of the short-termism of it. Because, as you said, it is asking for £4 billion of taxpayers' money. No politician in a five-year term really wants to do that. So they say, oh, it's probably okay for another five. Let's just let it, you know, maybe Labour will be back in government by the time they have to deal with this. It's not a good PR story.
Go on, Tom.
I was going to say, what about a nice, you know, commercial sponsorship deal, get the private sector involved. Very controversial.
The Gazprom Parliament.
This is,
when
people, this is, well, the opposite of what you were saying.
My views have moved on.
Always 180 degrees.
Always
about
controversy
2 minutes.
When, for example, sporting stadiums are renamed for some big, you know, faceless corporation full of, you know, evil people.
Let's not
individuals.
Name them.
No, let's not name names. Why not? You know, Gazprom Parliament, I think it's got a good ring to it. I can't see any obvious conflicts of interest there.
No, indeed. The Qatar Airways People's Assembly. Chris, you spent a lot of time in the Gulf. The Burj Khalifa, tallest structure in the world. Do you know how much that cost?
Top of my head, no.
$1.5 billion US dollars. That's £1.1 billion. That's So that's a quarter of one parliament. Knock it down and build the Burj Khalifa. Although, of course,
I'm sure they are drawing that up in the Gulf right now.
Although, if we did that, we would then have to do it for that price. Have to ship in lots of labour from Nepal, India, Pakistan. Pay them very little in the amount of money. Mm-hmm. So you can understand why it costs a little bit more here, Tom. Matt raised the idea of Parliament moving outside London while this refurb goes on. It's probably unlikely to happen because it's not just then Parliament, then you'd have to move outside of London. It's like, what do you do with all the ministries? Because, you know, MPs and ministers have to be part of their ministries. They can't be schlepping back and forth between...
Well, this is the thing. And regardless of the buildings, you know, the actual, the bricks and mortar, London remain, you know, even in that case, it would remain the de facto capital. And it would actually, it's reminiscent of this ridiculous EU thing where people would schlep from, you know, to one city to another periodically, supposedly in the name of, you know, being inclusive and being flexible, but actually it was a huge waste of money.
Precisely the sort of thing. To keep the French happy.
Well, I didn't want to say that explicitly.
Yeah, but it really is.
But that upset everybody. And I think if you started to have that kind of ridiculous, you know, Whitehall caravan journeying around the country at, you know, even more expense, people would quickly...
And that's what they said about Istanbul and Ankara, of course, you know. When Ankara became the capital city, lots of those old political class, or the new political class of the Republic, didn't like the fact that they had to go to this sort of random village in the middle of the country.
Well, I think I might have just happened to stumble upon the solution about what we do when Parliament is closed down. Because also this week, one of Britain's best-known clubs, Fabric, it was announced, is going to close permanently after its licence was revoked. I don't know whether MPs would necessarily want to move there. I'm sure many of them have been there before. Leading figures who've played at the venue have urged a rethink, arguing that the club plays an important role in the heart of London. Before I hear from Tom, Matt and Chris, let's hear from our culture editor, Robert Bound, who had this to say.
People have laid non-ironic wreaths of flowers outside Fabric, the nightclub that started. It's had a 15-year career. It's the only nightclub in Britain that's been famous throughout the world since the Hacienda in Manchester in the sort of early 90s in its heyday. One cannot take anything away from these two sad drug-related deaths at all, but you can take 15 years of culture and 15 years, 20 years of hope away from people that had a lot of good times, a lot of safe times, from a beacon of hope and mostly civility bang in the middle of London that people would flock to from all over the world.
That was Rob Bound speaking a little bit earlier. And Tom, this comes following the deaths of two people in two separate incidents over the last few months at Fabric, both deaths drug-related. But the idea that if you close a nightclub, somehow you're going to... That therefore means that fewer people will take drugs and that they will take them in somehow a safer way than in a place like Fabric is nonsense, surely, isn't it?
I think it is nonsense. It's a typical piece of sort of municipal wrongheadedness. It's a back-to-front way to look at the problem, if you like, of drug use or drug abuse or whatever you're going to call it. And I think the point that Rob makes is the important thing here, which is it's kind of taking a sledgehammer to crush a walnut. Okay, there may have been some infringements. You can tackle those with fines. You can insist that people, whether it's the security that they use or how they work with council officials to observe strictures about noise or whatever the problems have been. But to close something down, I think is a bit heavy-handed. I mean, I didn't know if you were going to ask us about our own experiences potentially of Fabric. And to sort of paraphrase that old thing about Woodstock, which is that if you could remember it, then you weren't there. I have indeed been there in the early days, I should add. And appropriately enough, I can remember virtually nothing of that evening.
Ironically, prior
and post actually being at Fabric. So I guess that's, is that good or bad? I'm not really even sure anymore.
I was going to bring out my one Fabric anecdote so that I could say I can speak about this subject with some sort of sense of authority because I did go there once in 2003, but we'll leave it. Matt, in the clip we played earlier from Rob, he sort of juxtaposed the fact that we now have in London a night tube. You can get the tube on a Friday and Saturday night, all the way through the night. But now with Fabric, and Fabric is just the latest of many, many other clubs that have been closed down, there's nowhere to go out at night. What does this tell us about London's nighttime economy, and what other examples are there of cities around the world battling with this idea?
Completely. I mean, it's really interesting you mentioned that, because I think there's something, the figure is absolutely shocking. In the last 10 years, the number of nightclubs in the UK, I think particularly in London, has something like halved. And I think a lot of this is down to, you know, there not being the same demand, but a lot of it is down to kind of, as Tom said, kind of municipal wrongheadedness, a lovely, lovely phrase. It boils down to the kinds of cities we want to live in, I guess. London, for people who don't know London, the nightlife is really not what you would expect from a major capital city, one of the biggest, best cities in most, by most sort of ways of quantifying it, one of the best cities in the world. But the nightlife is terrible compared to New York, compared to, you know, Berlin, most cities in, most capital cities in Europe.
But better than Sydney.
Better than Sydney. I mean, I was in Sydney in January, and there, kind of the nanny state has really ruined the nightlife there. The New South Wales government introduced laws requiring venues to refuse new guests after 1:30 a.m. And they basically stopped selling alcoholic drinks from 3 a.m. And it's turned the centre of Sydney into a complete sort of deserted wilderness, urban wilderness in the middle of the night. And it's very sad.
Chris, in Istanbul, they've had different sorts of battles, really, haven't they, about nightclubs and bars?
They really have, Steve, yeah. And I think it comes back to the idea about why is it valuable to have nightclubs? Why is it valuable to have a nightlife, simply as that? You know, I think You know, I think for a lot of people, when they came to Istanbul, when they come to Istanbul, one of the things that's so striking about it is that you have this extraordinary Hellenistic areas, you know, these nightlife areas like Beyoğlu. You can see people out on the street drinking. There's, you know, there's a raucous atmosphere that I think kind of presents a very liberal face of that country to people who go there to do business or to or just go as tourists. One thing that I think I just wanted to pick up, though, that Rob said was you referenced the Hacienda in Manchester, which is where I'm from. And, you know, I never went to Hacienda because it was before my time. But what makes me in a way sad is that the only thing that remains of the Hacienda is luxury housing called the Hacienda apartments. So, you know, when we start to turn these vital bits of these vital conduits, as Rob said, of culture into real estate, if that's the future of what these things, you know, these, we start to gut out these vital parts of the city that are nightlife economy, I would say.
About a week or so ago, Tom, Sadiq Khan, the new mayor of London, said that he was going to introduce what he's calling a night czar, known as a nightmare elsewhere, but he obviously didn't like that as a name. We've seen it in Amsterdam, perhaps most famously with our friend Mirik Milan. But if you're going to have a night czar and you're going to have a mayor like Sadiq Khan who says that he didn't want Fabric to be closed, what is this night czar going to do? What's the point in having these, but saying, oh, it's really important, if then actually you can't do anything about it, or you choose not to do anything about it?
Well, yeah, I think you answered the question there with the first remark. It's not that they choose to do nothing, it's that they're powerless. You know, it's all well and good to talk about the value to a nighttime economy, but one of the drivers here, and I think Chris is right, we've seen it in Manchester, you see it in London, you see it around here in Marylebone, everywhere, is that, you know, residential wins. And the problem you've got is not just that takes the bricks and mortar away where these things can happen, where you can have cultural capital as well as actual capital, but you lose the people. And we, especially in parts of London, these places aren't even filled with people who then want to consume local services or provide new ones themselves. They might only be there some of the time or none of the time. And so you start to lose the fabric, for want of a better phrase, of the community. And I think that the damage to social and in social and capital cultural terms is much more serious. And you can talk about, you know, the value to the economy, but ultimately I don't think there'll be any traction, because, you know, Sadiq Khan can say what he likes, but I don't think he's going to confront, say, the next big developer who wants to turn some rotting Victorian husk into the next big residential tower or whatever. He's going to be more than happy to be there with his little hard hat and his high-vis shaking hands. So, yeah, I wouldn't say it's a hypocrisy. I think they're just dealing with the challenges that everyone in government, local, city face around the world.
Matt, I guess there's a danger when you talk about nighttime economy that it ends up just being a discussion about people getting pissed or taking MDMA or doing whatever at night, whereas actually there's a discussion to be had about interesting retail at night, about restaurants opening late. It's, you know, whenever any of us go to Tokyo and we've got a flight, you know, back the next morning at 6 or 7 in the morning, you know, we always end up somehow at a bookshop at 4 o'clock in the morning at, you know, Tsutaya or Tsutaya, because these places are open and they're full. They're absolutely round with people buying books at 4 o'clock in the morning.
You're absolutely right. And we did, you know, the July-August issue I brought down here just to remind myself. But for our kind of avid readers, they'll remember that the July-August issue had a kind of a nighttime economy bent to it. So we looked at the importance of the night in cities and how they affect our quality of life. And you're right that when we think about the nighttime economy, we're not just thinking about clubs. Clubs are obviously very important, but there are so many other things. I mean, the cities that we love and the cities we love to visit and live in are cities that have that vibrancy late into the night, but it's not just clubs. It is, as you say, it's retail, it's restaurants, it's bars, it's all sorts of things. And it's people doing very normal things at 3 a.m., which are actually some of the most charming cities, as you say, like Tokyo.
Chris, when you look at the Gulf cities, have they got sort of interesting nighttime economies that are thriving?
I think they have a different definition certainly than a nighttime economy here in London, what we might immediately think. You know, I think there is a kind of a joy to some of those places. You know, it's very late night places to eat that you can get around the Gulf. You know, a great Lebanese guy, everybody knows him. He's there all night. He's like a kind of a, he's like a de facto mayor of the night himself in a way. You know, he'll get scores and scores of people showing up.
There'll be families out late.
And that will be families out late. That's right. And it does, you know, if Dubai had been a case in point, extremely safe at night. You know, I mean, they've created a nighttime economy where people feel very, very at ease being out and about. But I think sort of a more familiar, what we would think of a nightlife in clubs and bars and so on, it's not quite there just yet because of obviously the restrictions on alcohol, which are having, you know, which have a far-reaching effect. You don't find that same sort of spreading out into the streets, people stood out in the street drinking. But I think you find something very different there, which is that very Gulf, people out eating, sharing together with families.
Okay, we'll pause things right there. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Coming up, people were left stranded overnight in cable cars above the French Alps. We'll ask our editors around this table about the strangest place they've ever spent the evening. Given that I've already heard the answers, we're actually going to substitute out Matt Allagaya, because his wasn't very exciting. Sorry, Matt. And replace him with Nolan Giles, our design editor. You'll hear from him in just a moment.
Hello. We should have breakfast together, and lunch and coffee and cake, and a forced beer or Aperol Spritz at sunset too. And we know the perfect spot. Come and join us at our London cafe that's just around the corner from our Midori House headquarters and also close to the Monocle shop too. While you have a great flat white made with all-pressed coffee, you will no doubt bump into our team and get to hear the latest about the Monocle world. You can also pick up the latest issue of the magazine. Oh, and we have a space for hosting private lunches and events too. Join us at 18 Chiltern Street in London and also at our outpost in the Hankyu Men's Department Store in Tokyo. We look forward to seeing you.
And you're back with Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield, here on Monocle 24. Still with me in the studio, our Istanbul Bureau Chief, Christopher Lord, our Executive Producer, Thomas Edwards, and formerly our Singapore Bureau Chief, but now firmly ensconced here in Midori House as our newly appointed Design Editor, Nolan Giles. Hello, Nolan.
Hello, Steve. How are you?
Very good indeed. God, it's just like hearing you on the phone. That's how you are. That's how you answer the phone. Anyway, you're here with us in studio. Welcome. And you've already been busy, haven't you? You've been out and about on the town, enjoying the nighttime economy.
I have been. I've been in Paris, been in London. I've only been here a week, so I've seen a bit of what's happening here. Maybe not enough just yet.
Okay, but tell us where you were last night.
Last night I was at the official opening for the London Design Biennale, which kicked off on the day, but there was the evening event last night. And I guess, you know, coming from Singapore where, you know, there's lots going on in the creative industries in Southeast Asia, there's a lot of optimism. Last time I was here, if you remember, it was actually the week after Brexit, so the mood was obviously...
To be honest, no one here remembers.
Nobody remembers.
The week after Brexit. It was just a dark,
it
dark
was a
stage.
Dismal place to be. And there was a lot of talk in the creative industries then about, you know, architecture firms, basically projects almost drying up, the fear that there's the creative industry is going to die out. So it's kind of nice to come back to London now and see something like this happening, see this sort of level of investment through the Biennale. With all these sort of international names there, you have this 37 exhibitors from all across the world, really good quality kind of across the board, you know, a few standouts and a few not so interesting installations, but all in all, a really sort of nice sunny vibe down there at Somerset House, so it was nice to be a part of that.
Good. We'll come on to some of those highlights in just a moment, but Chris Lord, there was a Turkish highlight as well, wasn't there?
There was a Turkish highlight, Steve. Yeah, so the Turkish design firm Autobahn, they kind of stepped up to this. So the brief of the Design Biennale was about utopias and Thomas More's idea of utopia and what that idea of a kind of fictional perfect society might mean and various people playing with that
idea. Is this
idea.
Funded by the government?
Our government or
Turkish government?
No, it's not actually. It's privately funded by an industrialist there in Turkey. But they really have. It's an interesting proposal. So they've created one of, you know, those pneumatic chutes that you used to send messages through in hospitals.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
yeah. So they've rigged one of those right through Somerset House. Quite elaborate. They've knocked through windows and everything, and it's sort of going right through all the corridors. And the idea is that you can put your wish, what you hope for society, what your idea of a utopia might be, into this pneumatic system. And watch it fly off into the abyss, and no one actually knows. I kept asking people, where does it go? And no one's really quite sure, you know, whether there's a
it's going to an incinerator.
Yeah, exactly. But actually, you know, I thought it was very nice. Autobahn are a great firm. They've done some fantastic. They're really known, I suppose, for their furniture, for their interiors, and to some extent, some of their architecture. We've featured them recently in the mag. But this was really nice. It was a good, interesting piece of conceptual design. And I think, you know, after this year that Turkey's had, to see a local firm coming out and talking about a wish machine and something a bit playful like that was good to see, I would say.
Nolan, more generally, this design biennale is modelled after the biennale in Venice. And is it perhaps surprising that it's taken London this long to have such a prominent design festival? Because there's been, yeah, in fact, a design festival, and there's been various things in the past, but this feels like a step up, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that it does take place in the same month as the London Design Festival, and we've been sort of trying to figure out what the association is, because they are two very different entities, but they obviously link in a lot of ways. As I was saying before, I mean, I think as it almost creates this design month in London, which is something that it kind of really needs right now to boost the creative industries, and it's very different in terms of, you know, the London Design Festival kind of sprawls out across the city. There's lots of big brands behind it, whereas, you know, we saw a lot of small, like Chris was saying, smaller firms getting behind their countries and representing their countries and doing things on a little bit of a smaller scale in an environment where they can kind of interact and, you know, I guess sort of network with these other countries on that smaller level. So it's nice to sort of see that.
The one thing I'd say, Steve, it's a bit too short. I think it's only 3 weeks, is that right? The actual biennale.
Yeah.
And, you know, all these extraordinary installations.
Venice goes on for months.
Yeah. That's for many, many months. But yeah. Again, the scale is quite different. But I would have thought they could have wrung a couple of months out of it at least.
You'd think. Okay, there we are. Let's move on now to our final story, I use a word loosely, of the evening. Around 30 people spent last night trapped in cable cars high above the French Alps. They had to be rescued after the cables became tangled in high winds. And it got us thinking, or at least it got our producer thinking, what's the most interesting and possibly the strangest place that our editorial team have spent the evening? We asked many of our younger members of staff, I think it's fair to say, earlier in the day. If you want to hear what they had to say, go to monocle.com/radio, click on the briefing, it's towards the end. Our maturer members of staff, Tom Edwards.
Dear me.
More experienced members of staff, Tom Edwards. The strangest place you've ever spent the night?
Well, this was pretty unsavoury, to be honest. I went to a Champions League football match at San Siro in Milan to follow the Lily Whites, Tottenham Hotspur. And after the game, flushed with glory, we were shown onto some buses, which we were told would take us directly to the city centre where we could join other fans amidst the revelry. Should have noticed that the windows had cages over them. There was a clue there. So we're all packed on board, off we set. Drove around, a few songs and this kind of thing going.
Was this a match that you won or lost?
No, we'd won.
Okay.
Drove around. Oh, someone pointed out, did we go past that already? Yes, we did. That was the containment policy. They put us on these buses and drove us round and round Milan for about 3 hours.
Seriously?
To bleed all the joy out of us. So that by the end, they let us off and we just filed away into the night and we couldn't enjoy the legendary Milanese hospitality.
Well, there we are. Maybe it's for your own safety.
Probably for the best in the long run.
Milanese hospitality, not quite so hospitable if your team has beaten them.
Exactly. As I understand, it can be a bit stabby at times.
Okay, there we are. I'm sure it won't offend anyone living in Milan. Chris Lord.
Mine's quite similar, actually. July coup in Turkey. And as it started to unfold in Turkey, I was on a small island just off the coast of Istanbul, having birthday drinks with my girlfriend.
We couldn't reach you. I had to come on air and describe what was happening there.
Only you held the fort for a minute, yeah. Steve, before I rushed in. And then had to try and gallantly made my way back to the mainland and made my way down to the port, where I found a big group of very, very pro-Erdogan loyalists assembled on the port, all wearing Turkish flags like capes. And they invited me to join them on the boat. Fortunately, I was wearing a Hawaiian shirt, so I looked like a tourist rather than a journalist.
Excellent.
And I got stuck with them until well into the wee hours before they dropped me off in Istanbul.
Nolan Giles, top that.
I cannot top that, unfortunately. I don't have a one-night story to match Chris's. I can say that Thomas Reynolds, who is our managing editor here and looks after our bookings, has sent me to quite a few strange and random places across Southeast Asia.
Are you using this as an opportunity to complain publicly about the hotels that you're putting when you're traveling?
It's much my fault as it is his fault. You know, we don't know these. Sometimes there's places in Vietnam that we don't know very well, and we have to sort of use booking.com to figure out the best location. And sometimes the price.
You're giving away all the trade secrets, then, Adam.
The price doesn't. The cheap price and the beautiful looking photos of the hotel mean the location can be quite dirty sometimes.
Okay, well there we are. We will sort that out, or Tom Reynolds will. I'm afraid we don't have time for me to tell my story. But there we are. Midori House was produced by Rhys James. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Luke Saunders. The studio manager was Toby Hammond. My thanks to Chris, to Nolan, to Tom, and of course, the wonderful Matt Alagaya, who came down a little bit earlier. There'll be music next. Then it's The Menu with Marcus at 1900. Do stay tuned for that. The Daily is later. Midori House back on Monday, 1800 London time, 1300 in New York. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Have a lovely weekend. Goodbye.